Hi guys, it's Erin from the Spinning on Some Crime podcast, and I'm here today and doing something just a little bit different than I normally do. Today, I will have three guests on. I will have Shayna and Tate from the Light the Way Foundation, and I will also be joined by Ashley to discuss the case of her niece, Hazel Homan, who changed the entire direction of Ashley's life. Hazel was just 3 years old when she was murdered by her father's girlfriend under the watchful eye of the Washington State Department of Children, Youth, and Family Services. Today, we'll talk about how many families feel like DCYF is failing them and have failed children and will continue to fail children going forward. And we'll touch on Hazel's journey, which is what Hazel's loving family refers to her as. And of course, we will touch on Hazel's case and how it pushed Ashley to create legislation and change her whole career path to make sure that no more children go through what Hazel went through. Before we jump into that interview with Ashley, Tate, and Shayna, I would like to start with a letter written by Hazel's aunt, Ashley, about Hazel and the reason that she's fighting to change the system. In November 2019, my niece Hazel was tortured and murdered by my brother's girlfriend while under the supervision of the Department of Child Services. Hazel was first taken from my brother and her biological mother during a domestic violence dispute in November of 2017. Child Protective Services contacted my mother to let her know what had happened and that we could come get Hazel from the Bellingham DCYF office. When they arrived, they let my mother and stepfather know that they could take Hazel back to their home in Olympia, Washington, but that Hazel would remain a dependent of the state of Washington. My mother, who was unaware at the time that they were even going to place Hazel in the state custody, was left with no choice other than to agree and sign their contract, or they were not going to allow Hazel to leave the DCYF office with us. Hazel was then placed in their care for the next year and 7 months. My mother and stepfather loved and cared for Hazel like she was their own. Hazel was thriving when she was with them, and she was loved and supported by the whole family. Ever since Hazel was born, I called her my little angel baby, but I never thought she would actually be an angel so soon. In June 2019, CPS returned Hazel to my brother's care, and she was to have mandatory weekly child check-ins, but from the DCYF child fatality report on her, there was a lot of documentation that was missing or never completed. Days later, after she was pronounced brain dead from the abuse she suffered, we found out that there were other medical findings that were either not reported or not investigated by medical professionals or CPS while in the care of her father and his girlfriend. Some of the injuries Hazel suffered were second-degree burn to her hands, a chemical burn to the eye, and multiple different bones that were in different stages of healing. Due to DCYF's confidentiality policy, no one was ever notified or informed of any of these injuries, or we would have stepped in right away. The last incident that took Hazel's life happened on November 27th, 2019. After two brain dead assessments were conducted on 11:30, Hazel was pronounced brain dead. After that, Hazel was then left on life support until December 4th, 2019, because even though her body suffered burns and bruises, she was still able to donate three of her organs to help save the lives of three others. What the enemy brought for evil, God was still able to deliver miracles. After everything that happened with Hazel, it started an undeniable fire and passion in my soul to be her voice and help bring awareness and change. Over the last 3 years, my hands were tied because we were fighting for Hazel's justice. But on August 2nd, 2022, she finally received that justice, which allowed me to step out in faith and begin to be her voice. The Light the Way Foundation has been running a campaign called My Reason. And as you can see, Ashley's reason for changing the system is Hazel, but more importantly, to protect any babies from ever having to walk the same path that her niece did. So you guys, this is a little bit of a longer interview because we talk about not only Hazel, but how the system is broken, how we think we can fix it, and our own experiences in the system. So this is going to be a two-parter. I'm going to release both parts the same day, of course. That way, if you need to step back and take a break, because this is a heavy episode, but we feel like it's an important one, especially in this month of child abuse awareness. Welcome, ladies. Okay, so we have Shayna and Tates from Light the Way, and then we have Ashley, who was introduced to me through these two lovely ladies. So I want to start with you, Ashley. I've heard about your niece, Hazel, and I would love to hear how you got involved with what, let's start with what you do and how you got there.
I was originally going to school for nursing, and then everything that happened with Hazel kind of flipped my life upside down. When it first happened, I didn't understand. I was really struggling to even believe that it was a reality. Like, these are things that you see on like podcasts and crime shows and, you know, things like that. But to have it happen in your own family, really just kind of blew me away. So when that happened, it really opened up some doors for myself. I had, quite a bit of childhood trauma myself. So that kind of struck me in a different way. It kind of made me realize like how much it is prevalent and how much DCYF actually fails children continuously. I just had this awakening and I stopped going for nursing. And I started going for my bachelor's in social work. I also at that time became a DV and SA advocate in a shelter for a nonprofit. And that really opened my eyes to the different types and different forms of domestic violence. After that, then I just kept diligently working. I was going through the whole criminal investigation when it came to Hazel's case and Cammy and all of that. And that was really hard. It took 2 years and 7 months to even be able to get the justice for Hazel. I, at that time, wasn't able to really speak up or say anything because I didn't want to be the reason that Hazel didn't get justice. And they kind of intimidated me and like feared me into believing that if I spoke up and I tried to be a voice for Hazel or anything, that I could potentially mess up the case. So as soon as the case was finished, that's when I really started to speak up and try to be a voice for Hazel. I have started trying to talk to legislators about changes that need to be made here in Washington State. I met these two wonderful ladies, and they've really helped me to bring awareness. And their mission and their goal, when I was reading their Facebook and their website, I was just blown away at everything that they've done to help other people. And they really helped me to kind of start believing in myself more, that I could make a difference and that I could keep speaking out. And they actually got me my first meeting with one of the legislators, which I was very thankful for. And then it just kind of was a snowball effect from then. I just kept reaching out more and more to different legislators. It gets really discouraging and really hard because, I mean, I've been rejected. I've been, kind of like laughed at. I've been ignored completely. And, Tates and Shayna really just, showed me and told me, like, don't give up. Keep going. They're real raw people, and they also are fighting for changes, and they just have really been there to inspire me and just help motivate me to keep going. Now, I graduated in December with my bachelor's in social work. I am going in May to actually walk in Arizona where I graduated so that my children, my two girls, can see me. And now I work as a foster or as a family preservation services for foster families. Sometimes it will be families that are struggling with parenting or communication or need some counseling. And I go into the homes. I did visit supervision for almost 2 years, which is, basically, I would transport the youth, observe, take notes, you know, just be there for their safety. Now I actually am in the homes working with the families. I really like that a lot more because I'm able to be more of an impact and be able to be more resourceful for them. I'm also in the home, so I'm able to observe and see if there's any red flags that I notice or anything that comes up that may be suspicious. I took a lot of different trainings for all of this, and yeah, I really enjoy it. And it really made me realize that you can turn your pain into your passion. And I feel like even though what happened to Hazel, that the universe, God, creator, whatever you want to call it, really helped put me on the path to my purpose. And it's just sad that it happened the way that it did. But there is a good thing. There is a good thing about Hazel's story, that even though what, you know, was meant for evil and horrible, she was able to save three different children's lives in the process of losing hers. And her middle name is Journey. And I always say her journey still goes on in those other children.
That's beautiful. Absolutely. Do you think that DCYF has changed since first dealing with Hazel? Are you seeing any changes?
No. And it's actually gotten worse. To me, they did the HB 1227 bill. And basically within that bill, it includes like things like substance abuse, inadequate housing. Like pretty much there's like nothing that can get a child removed from the home. And since that has happened, there has been many more deaths of children. A lot of it when I, because I did a slideshow actually for a group of legislators, and the three highest risk factors were substance abuse, domestic violence, and mental health. And it has continued with this fentanyl epidemic and this drug epidemic that there has been just more and more children not being removed from these homes and ending up either being abused, neglected, or even murdered. There was a new bill that came out this year. It was the 6109. I'm going to read just this little part.
Of course.
It says, the court shall give great weight to the presence of high-potency synthetic opioid in the home or exposure of the child by a parent or guardian or legal custodian to a high-potency synthetic opioid, which may require removal of the child to prevent imminent physical harm due to child abuse and neglect. Basically, in this new bill, it says that it's giving great weight. It is not removing the child from these homes. It is just basically putting the choice in the judge's hands. And since this has happened, she actually, because this bill passed, there were many amendments that were made by another legislator named Travis Couture. And he really has been fighting here to strengthen this bill. Because since then, there has been, that I know of, there's actually one overdose death here in my actual little town. But there has been four that I know of since this bill was put through in March. I want to say it was March when it was passed. She actually asked me if I would come there and be a representative of this bill. And I professionally and respectfully had to decline because I do not feel that it is a representation of who I am, what I believe, and what I stand for. So this next session coming up is going to be longer, and I'm going to really try to be a voice for these children and be a voice for Hazel and fight for bigger change.
Absolutely. And I have a question for all three of you ladies from a child's perspective who understands this road, and also as a parent perspective who has worked with struggling addicts, sex workers, and people with housing issues. When it comes down to these bills being so black and white, I absolutely believe that there should be an intervention when it comes to substance, sex work, housing, right? But it's not all black and white. So before we remove a child, before we take a child from their home that they may be loved in or used to, I'm not saying that they're not being, let's just go with the, before we jump in and remove a child, because that's what we want to do, is keep them with family if we can, if they're safe. Does these states have in their bill something that can step in and say, okay, we might have a housing problem here. Before we remove this child, how do we help the housing problem? Before we fully remove this child, how do we help this addiction problem? Do we have things in place in these states before we have these black and white bills?
I think we do. And the problem is that these parents have the opportunity to opt out of these things, and they're not forced to take these recommended services. And we can speak from Oakley Carlson's case specifically, that her parents in January of 2021, when there was a phone call made to her house because of concerns about Oakley, DCYF knocked on their door. They looked at the children. Services were offered. And we know from court documented paperwork that they refused those services and nothing was done to then protect the kids. And then we know that a month later, in February 10th, that is the last sighting of Oakley Carlson, and now she's been missing. So the problem is we have, and we believe that this is a, you know, nonpartisan issue. We stand by that 100%. We are a nonpartisan organization, but we have two parties that believe it is a partisan issue. We have one side that says, let's give support, but keep them together. And then we have another side that says, we're in dire straits. We need to remove these children. And there is no middle ground. And what's happening is that children are just dying. And so at this point, because parents are allowed to opt out of those services, we have no choice but to remove some of these children immediately, because they are in harm's way, because nobody is holding some of these families accountable. There was a little boy, I believe it was last month, his name was Ariel Garcia. In Washington, there was actually an Amber Alert put out for him, but by the time the Amber Alert was put out, he had been murdered by his mother. And he wouldn't have been removed according to the new law that was put into place in March that would have protected him from possible fentanyl use. His mother had just relapsed on methamphetamines. So this law that, you know, says it's okay for parents to have their children and be on methamphetamines wouldn't have protected this child. He was stabbed 41 times by his mother when she relapsed. So where is this line that we're going to protect these children? Because we have these parents who are addicted, who are not accepting these services, and then these children are dying. And in Washington, it's an epidemic. In 2022, we had 85 children die under the watch of DCYF. And in the year below, it was in, and I don't want to give the exact number, but it was in the 70s. So in 2 years, that's over 150 children dying under the watch of a state agency that's job is protect these children. I mean, That to us, the three of us, is just horrific. When are we going to do something to protect these children? And, you know, we're reaching out to legislators, but we're also reaching out to the people who are in charge of this state agency. Ross Hunter, he is the secretary of DCYF. He won't return a phone call. He won't return an email. We reach out to the ombuds office, who is the watchdog agency for DCYF. they won't reply either. There's just no comment. You know, they hide behind the, you know, cases are protected, we can't make comments, but yet there's no, we're going to try and make this better. There's just no comment at all. And that's scary. You know, there should be, I understand that, you know, they have to keep the records of the children private. I understand that. But where's your understanding that there's an epidemic here and you need to keep children safe? And that's where I think all of our hearts come from. Obviously, Ashley, she is absolutely amazing. Tates and I feel so honored to work with her. We met in, you know, in the craziest of ways to just be able to see her advocating for her niece. And then we heard Hazel's story. And then we were like, we were starting a campaign called My Reason. And it was kind of advocating for children who had been failed by DCYF through our Light the Way, which is typically a missing persons advocacy group. But we found that with Oakley's case, we couldn't turn our backs on these children who were being failed by Washington DCYF. And we were finding out that Oakley was not the only one. There were so many more. So we saw Ashley advocating, and we had seen her on Oakley's page kind of telling Hazel's story. We saw her advocating at the Oakley Carlson Act when it went to a hearing in front of the legislator. And so we reached out to her and we connected, and Ashley has been running since. Every time we have an idea, she has an idea, we're connecting. We're so proud of her for graduating. I mean, what an amazing turn of events in her life, and she's going to go on to do great things. I mean, talk about getting in the trenches and actually making changes. I mean, you can't do more than what she's doing. And Ashley has been able to organize actual rallies at the Capitol building, and we've been able to get legislators to attend and just, you know, shake hands and listen to these families, and foster parents have attended as well to, you know, unite with our small group and just work together, because it's these families who have lost children, it's advocates like our small group, and then it's foster families. We're all kind of uniting to say, look, enough's enough. We're hearing these horror stories about these babies being failed, and they don't have a voice. They're too little to have a voice. So we're going to be a voice for them. And we're lucky we've had some legislators who have kind of joined us and said, hey, keep doing this. We know it feels like you're not making much progress, but you are. You're being squeaky wheels, and that's what you need to do when you want to make change. And change sometimes, we've researched, it can take up to 7 years. So when you like start doing this and you start kind of pushing bills and stuff, it can take about 7 years for something to go through. So we're just at the beginning stages of that, which can feel kind of frustrating sometimes, but we know that there are kids that need to be protected, so we're going to keep on going. But we feel just honored to be able to tell some of these children's stories, like Hazel and Oakley, and there's more kids, like this little boy Ariel, and there's other kids. There was a little boy named Otis. He was an infant this past January who was killed when his father was overdosing on drugs, and he was unhoused and he was left for dead in a bush in Washington state. They're just horror stories, and we hear them over and over again. And we know that the laws are what's leaving these kids in harm's way.
Do you feel like it sounds like the failures are the optional choices? Like there's resources, but there's optional. Do you feel like the states are equipped when they do remove these children? Because we do have foster care horror stories too. So you can remove one child from a not great situation, even a dangerous situation, and put them in an even worse situation. Do you feel like we have the right resources in these states to handle if we take away these kids, if we do have options? Are we putting them in safe places?
So from our experience, and you know, we have a small experience, but we have only met wonderful, caring foster families who are so committed to keeping these children safe and who want them to return to their families, but return to their families when it is safe. We work with one incredible foster mom And she is friendly with Ashley as well. She helped to organize the rally, and she has been a foster mom for years and years. She's even adopted out of foster care. But they have had their home filled with foster children, and, you know, they will take whoever and whenever a child needs help. But what they have seen in recent years is that kids are just going in and out, which is not healthy for kids either. They're being returned, and then the same behaviors are happening. So parents really aren't, you know, getting clean or getting the resources they need to maintain that sobriety. So we need to look at that too. Like, are we really returning kids when it's appropriate? Because if you're returning a kid too soon, I mean, I know as a parent, it's stressful. Like, it's not easy to be a mom or a dad in this day and age. It costs money. It, you know, there's lots of decisions to be made. I can't imagine what that feels like when you're also addicted to drugs and that is like your number one priority. But in our experience, we have worked with wonderful foster parents who are committed. And that doesn't mean that there aren't bad situations, because we read about those in the news too. But we have not experienced that. We have not had people come to us in that situation. Our experience has been foster parents who are worried about their foster children returning to bad situations because of situations like Hazel's and like Oakley's and like the other kids that we really have kind of represented.
Do you feel like there's the appropriate oversight, I guess, in foster care in your state? Do you feel like there's the proper steps and oversight in that foster care over the foster care parents and the children attending in foster care, like where their milestones are their needs being met? How are their relationships when they're doing these meetings with their parents? Do you feel like there's proper, state oversight of that to make sure that we are giving these kids back at the right time, because we're going through, we have like a log of how they're progressing, how the family is progressing?
I can speak, and I'll let Ashley go next, but I can speak to Oakley's case, and I would say absolutely not. We know that Oakley was returned after she was basically adoption kind of route, and then something changed because a court record wasn't filed right, and then she was bit abruptly being returned. And then she didn't go through a process where she was building a bond with her bio parents, and it was just like, okay, now you're going home. None of that was done with oversight. She came back with bruises on her face, scratches on her face, and the supervisor who was there couldn't tell her foster family how she had those on her face. But the social worker who was on the case, Angela Fries, she was alerted to safety concerns. Oakley came home and talked about a domestic violence incident that she witnessed, and her parents had a history of domestic violence, criminal domestic violence. And she said, well, don't worry about it because Oakley loves her mom and dad. I mean, that is not supervision in our eyes whatsoever. And then she was returned and she goes missing. I mean, and DCYF wants no accountability to that. They're also, with DCYF, we have a CASA program, or a court appointed or guardian ad litem type program. And that's how the CASA works. A CASA is supposed to be checking in with a child and almost be their voice at court, because a foster parent isn't allowed to speak for them during court hearings. Oakley's guardian ad litem came two times in the 2.5, almost 3 years that she was with her foster parents. That's unacceptable. Like, that is not a proper representation of what that child's life was like. So Washington State needs to do better. We believe that their whole system needs a complete overhaul of how they look at their cases, how they're managed, you know, and we understand there's a lot of kids, but, and there's probably not enough workers. We understand that. But then that comes from the top down. The top down needs to think about how this is done. And just like education, there's not enough money. We get that. But somehow in education, we manage to get kids through, right? Like, these are more vulnerable cases. This is kids' lives we're talking about. It needs to become more of a priority, period.
Oh, absolutely. Because that's my worry about resources, too. We do need to remove these children, but we need to have a safe place to put them. And we hear about children sleeping in hotels 6 to 7 with one caseworker because they have nowhere to put them, sleeping on office floors. I slept in a library for 2 days. I mean, I understand that there is a lack of safe homes to put these children sometimes. And I also understand that there are foster parents saying, hey, I'm open. Why can't I get this child? Where are we failing in the system to make sure that the safe parents that do have these great homes, that have worked with, you know, other families and have a good success rate, aren't automatically the first choice that they go to? And why do we have children sleeping on floors in libraries, in hotels? Why do we have that system? Where are we failing, and how do we fix that?
I think for the littles, you know, for the younger kids, part of the problem is the main goal for DCYF is reunification. Reunification's great when it's great for that child. I mean, it doesn't fit every family. You know what I mean? Like, things need to be done before children are just returned to abusive situations or, you know, situations that can harm them.
Absolutely. And like you said, when you have these children, especially the little ones, they're removed from the home. They're not seeing their parent. Let's say they are in this foster program. They're bonding with these foster parents. And, you know, adoption might be on the table. Or the foster parents might say, you know, I'm going to be here for the long haul, whatever it takes to get them back to their family. But if they're not seeing their bio parents and continuing to build that relationship, we're just re-traumatizing this child. We're ripping them from one place to another and almost putting them back with strangers now.
Exactly.
Strangers we're hoping are doing the work. And then we have, eventually, you get older through the system and now you're a teen. And I feel like we fail teens just as much as we fail little ones, because teens, we have a clock. We have a, when I turn 18, and some of us had a, once I'm 18, I know I will survive clock. But as you're a teen, then they start looking at your behaviors, what you're doing, if you're running away, if you're not working the system. Because like you said, you can have a guardian ad litem come, and next thing you know, you have a new one who doesn't even know you that shows up at your court appearance. So what do we do for the teens in that situation? And how do we change the conversation that they might be a troubled teen? I hate that word. They might be a runaway. And we look at the system as a whole and we get those kids to help just as much as we do the littles.
I want to say it's so hard, because I'm going to go kind of back to your question when it came to like the foster parents and the parents and
absolutely,
which side is better. And, you know, it's so hard because you do hear horror stories about foster parents and you do hear horror stories about parents. So if you swing one way too much, then, you know, you're putting that kid in harm. If you swing the other way too much, you're putting that kid in harm. It's so hard because, like you said, everything is so black and white, but they're human beings and we're all human beings and we're not black and white. And so therefore, like, each case really needs to be individualized. But then it kind of goes back to when it comes to social workers. Like, social workers are extremely, and this is hard for me to talk about because, like, the social worker that worked with Hazel's case, Hazel went through 4 social workers within her 5 months that she was back with my brother and his girlfriend. That is outrageous. That means that, you know, pretty much almost every month she had a new social worker that came on the case that literally didn't know the situation and could only read the case notes. And that's the thing. When these social workers are overworked, a lot of stuff falls through the cracks. There were, you know, missing information in Hazel's case. There were case notes that were never finished. So this new caseworker is coming on and they're seeing, you know, half of the story. Then they, you know, they go to the homes, and I kind of understand this because this is kind of what I do. I do not work for DCYF. I am a self-employed subcontractor. But I do work with these families and I do case notes, and, you know, I do see the high turnover rates in these situations, because I do work with the social workers. I do work with the CASAs. I do work with, you know, people that are involved with the child and with the families. And I agree with you when it comes to whether they're littles, whether they're, you know, young young kids, whether they're adolescents, whether they're teenagers, whether they're 18 and, you know, coming out. And that's why I say, like, it's just such a fine line. Like, here we now have extended care, which is 18 to 21. So they kind of help them transition a little bit more, which is good. You know, it's just so hard because trauma is so complicated and so complex, and every child is different. So yes, if you have a child who is, you know, running away at 14 years old because they don't like where they are, whether that's with a foster parent or with a parent, and, you know, and they're having trouble in school. And that's why I feel like being able to really learn how to communicate with these children is so important, and to be trauma informed, because, you know, one, if you're not, you're going to look at it as like a behavioral problem and could lead to like punishment and things like that. When really it's just they're teens. They don't know how to self-regulate their emotions. They're dealing with traumas. I remember when I was 14, I was off the hook. I was off the hook. I was not in school. I was drinking. I was smoking weed. I was, because I didn't know how to deal with my trauma. And I didn't have anybody there to kind of rein me in. Like, I didn't have a good relationship with my mother. I didn't have a good relationship with my father. And my grandparents pretty much raised me, but they both passed away by the time I was 13. So I was kind of like on my own. And I didn't feel like anybody had any authority over me because they didn't raise me. They weren't there for me. So I was very rebellious. And I wish so bad that I would have had somebody that, you know, would have been able to sit with me and like actually ask me and like try to figure out like what was actually going on with me. Because all I wanted was love. All I wanted was, you know, somebody to be there for me and to help teach me right. And when I was 15, I want to say, I was emancipated from my mother. I was in foster care for a little while because she didn't want me to go live with my boyfriend's mom. So she instead wanted me to be in foster care. So I was in foster care for a while, and I was with families, and it was rough because I was going from place to place. And then finally they put me into like a teen home. And I really liked that. Honestly, some people may not, but I really liked that because I liked it too. You did? Like, that
I
was
did.
My, that
I
was
did.
My favorite because Mine I felt too. Like there were mentors there that had experienced what I had experienced. There were teenagers there who had kind of experienced the same things I experienced. So I didn't feel like I was alone in the process.
Right. And you weren't the bad kid anymore. You were in a room full of people that finally knew what you were going through. And
yes,
you could relate, and also sometimes look at other people and go, wow, man, that's worse. Like, you know, yeah. And sometimes you need that. As weird as that sounds, sometimes you need to be like, okay, wow, it's pretty crazy the things that we've lived through and what we can go through. And I feel like the homes have really good counselors and people that are there for the right reasons, and you do get that stability, and suddenly your roommates are everybody that knows what you're going through versus foster care. You can connect with a kid and then they disappear and you never see them again. And, or you have another kid there that has bigger issues or bigger problems, and so you're overshadowed by that. I mean, there's so many things when it comes to foster care, when you have multiple different kids with different issues, because you have great foster parents with great intentions, but they are not trained in the way that those group home counselors and resident advisors are. So that was a favorite for me too. Which I find funny, like the more I talk to other people that grew up same time as I did and going through that system, when they landed in that group home, we want it to just be left alone. Leave us in our group home. But many of us got ripped out.
See, and that's the thing is, like, I've been talking to my husband because I ultimately, my goal is to start a nonprofit in honor of Hazel. And I kind of have been talking to him about like Hazel houses. So that are kind of like group homes. And because I agree with you. I felt like I was not alone there. I felt like the counselors really understood. And I think that also something when you work in anything like that, when you work as a social worker, when you work as, you know, I think even a legislator personally, but like when people's lives are in your hands and their safety is in your hands and you're working in those kind of trauma environments, I think it's important to have some kind of experience, whether that's work experience, life experience, you know, anything like that, because then it kind of really, you're able to have that compassion and that empathy and really be able to put yourself in that kid's shoes or that person's shoes. And when it comes to like the young ones, like Shayna and Tate are talking about, the older ones have a voice. Yes, sometimes it may not be heard, you know, or seen, but they're able to have a voice. The younger ones are not able to have a voice, and they're the most vulnerable population. And so when it comes to removing the child or you know, whatever, and it comes to things like drug addiction, I believe in recovery. I have had Absolutely. Drug addiction throughout my family, my friends, you know, I've even lost people to drug addiction. So, but I've also watched people that I never thought would recover and live a healthy and safe life. And I actually have a friend who I met through Hazel passing away that was actually reunified with her kids. But she had to go through the steps. She had to do the work before she was able to get her kids. Now, like Shayna said, it's voluntary. Even me going into people's homes and working with them on parenting, on communication, on, you know, life skills, things like that, it's voluntarily. I've had people literally be like, oh, this is voluntarily. Okay, F you. I don't want your services, you know? And so I don't believe that you can force somebody into getting clean. I know you can't. Right. I tried. You can't beg somebody. You can't force them. You can't make them.
You can't take away their children as a wake-up call. Like, it just, it until they're ready to get clean, it's never going to happen.
Yes. But if you're not willing to do the work and you're putting your kids in jeopardy and, you know, they talk about the money situation all the time. Money always comes into it, financial. Okay, but you're actually paying for people to have lock boxes to put their drugs into and put their drugs up, but you're not willing to fork out the money for, you know, more resources or trying to, you know, get it to where it's hard, because I think that part of it should be voluntary to see which parents want it and which ones are like, screw this, I don't want these services, I don't care. Because that's the other thing is I notice doing this work is I see parents that are forced into being parents that literally have told me to their face, I don't want this responsibility. And then they're forced into it, which then causes more trauma with the child. Like, I have a situation where this parent told me, like, they didn't want to be a parent. So then they start self-sabotaging. They start not showing up for visits. Then the kids start taking that on as, oh, they don't want to see me. They don't, you know, they don't love me, whatever. That is the most heartbreaking thing to see. And so the thing about the voluntary, why I'm like back and forth with it, is because it kind of weeds out the ones that want it and the ones that don't want it. And I've seen, you know, I've seen parents who have wanted it and did the work and worked to get their kids back. One of the cases that I just got done as a visit supervisor, she just got all three of her cases back, and I worked with her for a year and a half and she did the work. But then I've also seen other cases where they don't want to do the work. And then they start self-sabotaging, and then it just hurts the child even more.
Okay, guys, we're going to take a break here. It was kind of hard to decide where to split it because the conversation continues to flow. So we're going to stop here. We're going to take a break. But remember, part two is loaded. And I want to thank everyone who's made it this far and who's going on to the second part, because learning about this and educating ourselves really makes the difference. So thank you. I know this was a heavy episode.
I want to apologize for the audio not being perfect. You know, we're recording around life happening around us, as well as my mic mute for the second time is not working. So you hear me move, you hear me take a drink, and I didn't want to cut all that out and miss the parts of the conversation that were important. So thank you for sticking through that, because I know there are people that are just like me, that audio quality is important, and sometimes it makes it hard to stick through when it's not perfect. So thank you for sticking it out. And don't forget, every time you see those missing and murdered posts on social media, to hit like, share, and retweet. Every time we share a face, we get closer to solving a case. Until next time.